Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, celebrating a Jacksonville writer whose massive manuscript archive takes center stage this weekend at the Jacksonville Main Library. We hear the poetry of Alan Justice and from the people who knew him best. Later in the program, a look at this weekend's biggest arts and cultural events, from free riverfront concerts to sandcastle competitions by the sea. But first, more than a decade after his death, the work of the prolific and problematic poet, Alan Justice, becomes a permanent part of the Jacksonville Public Library. We're joined now by Claire Manos, Special Collections Librarian at the Main Library. Hi, Claire.
Hi.
We're also joined by some of the people who worked with and personally knew Alan Justice, including photojournalist Walter Coker. Hey, Walter.
Hey, Ann.
Musician and video artist Troy Lucarilla. Hey, Troy.
Hello.
And Tim Gilmore, author, educator, and historian at Jack's Psychogeo.
Hey, Ann.
Nice to have you on. Tim, Alan Justice is a complicated dude, but he is also something of a local legend. Tell us a little bit about his personal background and who he was.
Yeah, he was a complicated dude, that's for sure. Alan Justice, I should say I didn't know him as well as Troy and Walter knew him. To me, one of the things that keep Alan Justice fascinating are just these kinds of questions. There's a sense in which I think he haunts us. In fact, his one of Walter's photos of Alan is looking straight at me from across the room right now. What is his staying power? Why did so many people gravitate toward this person who had lots of characteristics that, you know, seem almost designed to drive people away? What was his, his relationship to writing? He gave his life to writing, decade after decade. What was his, why was the relationship between alcohol and writing what it was? All of those things are questions that keep me trying to answer them. He was, in many ways, people referred to him as the poet laureate of Jacksonville. I think he, there was something inextricably Jacksonville about Alan Justice that made for the kind of poet that he was. He grew up in this really fascinating part of town called Yukon.
That's kind of right across from NAS Jax.
It is, yeah. All kinds of strange stories about Yukon. He actually directed the first public play at what's now Florida State College of Jacksonville. I didn't know that until, a couple of weeks ago.
What was the play?
It was August Strindberg's The Father, which is also really interesting, just given Alan's own life story and his relationship with his father. In the earliest materials in FSCJ's archives, there's Alan Justice in 1966 reciting Robert Browning poems at the school, brand new school. And I'm kind of fascinated by, like, how do I connect that Alan to the Alan that, you know, that I met in the 1990s?
He had multiple wives. He had several children. In their words, I mean, he also was not an easy man. I think at his memorial service, his daughter Suzanne said he was not a good father, but he was a great man. And his wife called poetry and alcohol his mistresses.
Mm.
So it tells you a little bit, I guess, about some of the troubled relationships that he had in his own personal life.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was married to Grace Justice in the 1980s, who is also an absolutely fascinating individual. So many ways they seem so polar opposite of each other. It's always been kind of hard for me to imagine them having been married, but they were married for most of the, I think, 1980 to 89. Most of that time they lived in Texas, actually, on a small farm that Grace got started there. She's a macrobiotic cook, and she's into holistic healing. And it's hard for me to kind of reconcile that fact with the fact that the Allen Justice that I met later on seemed to live off of beer.
Yeah.
You know?
Walter, you met Allen Justice when you were shooting him for Folio Weekly. There was a cover story back in 94 called Poetic Justice. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your experience there the first time that you drove out to where he was living and how he was living.
Yeah, I'd been at Folio for a couple of years at that point. We'd been doing pretty light fare, really. Nothing, you know, super serious or hard hitting or anything. And then we're going to do a profile on a crazy poet someone said, I still remember, that lived out in the woods off Firestone Road. So I drove out there not really knowing what to expect, but not expecting a lot. And I got there and the scene that unfolded was kind of, I'll never forget it. It was a rundown teardrop trailer, a single cable running from a power line to the trailer. Alan was inside with a fedora on, a kerchief around his neck, long sleeve shirt. He had dressed up for the photos, but as I was there and he started drinking beers, the shirt came off, the hat came off, and he sat drunk, smoking and
shirtless.
typing poetry, very emotional. I was there for the entire afternoon, and the photos, I don't know, it was just that unfolded were, you know, something I'll never forget.
It's a pretty remarkable collection of photos from that day. They're also going to be part of the collection at the library. But tell us, at one point, he actually wanted to turn the camera on you.
Yeah. Alan said something when I got there that, you know, I'd never heard before. He said, you can only take my picture if I can take yours. And I was like, not sure what that means, but go ahead. Sure, I'll do that. And so I took some photos for a while, and I had to call the office to tell him why I was gone so long. And I borrowed his phone. A corded phone, of course. And while I was on the phone, he took my camera and started taking pictures of me. So the proof sheet that I have from that day has four pictures of me in the middle of the roll, which has never happened before or since.
He worked on a manual typewriter. He was very prolific. And he was a really interesting person. I spoke to Nestor Gill. He is perhaps the person most responsible for the preservation of Allen Justice's work and the creation of this new special collection. Now, he's currently a visual artist professor at Lafayette College in Pennsylvania, but he is from Jacksonville, and he was a 20-year-old in the early mid-90s in what was a really thriving poetry scene. And he wasn't able to join us today. He's actually on a plane on his way down here for this event Saturday. But I spoke to him last week, and I want to play a couple excerpts from that interview. The first, I asked Nestor about Allen's obsessive writing style as well as his unusual lifestyle.
I think he was an obsessive poet. I think that he worked in a kind of confessional style that echoed writers like The Beats and Charles Bukowski, but even more so like Robert Lowell and Sylvia Plath, although his stylistic choices didn't really mirror theirs. Mm-hmm. But the confessional mode that he worked in was really, I think, has echoes in their writing. And he was always at it. I don't know anyone in my entire life who I've ever known to be just so incredibly disciplined in terms of, you know, doggedly pursuing this one thing, not without regard for how things might turn out, but regardless of how things might turn out. The trailer, and Alan had a small light bulb there. It was like a 6x10 foot little camper. He had a light bulb on the extension cord. He had his typewriter, and he had public radio. Outside, he had 5-gallon buckets like painters use, one of them with a sheet of broken glass on it that he used as a kind of makeshift table, and another one with a piece of plywood over it that he used as a makeshift toilet. Early on, the impression that I had was that this was a person who was not normal. If you had a poetry reading, Allen Justice, G. Jerome Jones, and Al Letson, then I was going to attempt to do just everything I could to be impressive and skillful in my delivery and, you know, wise in my words. They were the bar. These people were the bar that I set for myself in terms of, you know, who do I want to impress? Who do I want to outdo? Who do I want to hear positive things from later? The reason I wrote Friday through Wednesday was so I'd have something great for Thursday to share, hopefully, with those guys. And Al Letson, sure, was a deeply important part of that. And he and Alan had a beautiful and at times, you know, stressful, like any one of us, a beautiful and at times stressful relationship, because Alan Justice was Alan Justice, and he was all kinds of incredible things, but he was never really easy. He was ever present. He liked the word barfly, and more often than not, when things went wrong, it was because Alan showed up having had too much to drink or decided to drink too much while he was at a given place. And then his filter came off, and he could be, you know, he could be kind of unkind when his filter came off, and he could mistake his unkindness for important wisdom that he was trying to impart to someone. But it would resonate as something other than wisdom. So he did get 86 from a lot of places because he, in fact, hurt a lot of feelings.
That's Nestor Gill, and he maintained this collection, Claire, for the last decade, carrying it around with him, and now he's handed it off to you at the library. Why should we care about this poet?
I mean, what a body of work to produce over a period of time, and it's just an interesting and fascinating snapshot of a person and just the work he put into it. And Nestor did a beautiful job of maintaining the collection and handing it off to us. When I'm arranging a collection, I consider original order, and I considered the order that Nestor had it in. And Alan's goal was very much every day to write 10 poems a day. And Nestor had grouped those by day. And so I myself and a coworker spent time foldering them in archival folders, And just making sure we properly did justice to Alan Justice's work.
Yeah. And so there's some 20,000 typed pages,
yes,
of this manuscript.
14 boxes is what Nestor brought us. And it's ended up in 38 archival boxes. And each is folded individually, because if you throw that sort of grouping and collectively in a folder, you're never going to find anything. So we've got some of Alan's personal papers in the beginning of the collection, and then it's all poetry in chronological order over the years.
So Nestor there was talking about the poetry scene and mentioned former First Coast Connect interim host Al Letson. He was a huge part of that scene. He won poetry slams all around the country at that time. Let's hear him reading one of Alan's poems.
Is Yours by Alan Justice. The beer is yours. The smoke is yours. The room is yours. The light is yours. The paper is yours. The food is yours. The time is yours. The control is yours. The bait is yours. The key is yours. The lock is yours. The word is yours. The truth is yours. The answer is yours. The song is yours. The question is yours. The reason is yours. The beginning is yours. The end is mine.
Troy, you were a friend of Alan's, but you were not a fan of his drinking. And you talked about that in the past, saying that, you know, he truly believed he had to be drunk to write good poetry. He said that he was a drunk, but he didn't think he was an alcoholic. I want to play a little piece of him, because you are working on a documentary. You've collected a lot of interviews for that. This is actually an interview you did with Alan. Obviously, we don't want to glamorize drinking as a pathway to art, but let's hear his view on this, and then let's talk about it.
Okay. For some reason, when I drink beer, and it doesn't happen with whiskey or any of those other things, it doesn't happen to me smoking herb, it doesn't happen with all those things, it just so happens that with beer, there's a particular point inside of me that is exposed, and I become very naked and vulnerable, but I wind up putting things down on a piece of paper. And I take responsibility for it, because I realize that it is a form of systematic drunkenness. Or in other words, I'm not drinking just to get drunk. I'm drinking to replace what I'm doing to myself. Accept it. I accept what I'm doing is my own answer.
Troy, what do you think about his relationship with drinking, and how did that affect your relationship with him?
It was a terrible relationship to begin with. Well, let's face it. This was a man who had a reputation of being a wreck. And my first interactions with him were at these open mics and stuff. And he'd get so drunk and everybody else kind of scattered. And there was this helpless poor man who needed a ride home. And that started to be my first interactions with him. And then out of the blue, I got a call from the from Alan Justice, because whoever was housing him at the time kicked him out. And I housed him in my own house. And that's when, oh man, how could anybody coexist with this human being? And it's up to, I mean, everybody else to make their judgment of whether did the drinking, was it a lie? Was it, did he really need to drink? I do think that it got it started. And I think Nestor has mentioned that once a few drinks, he wrote some pretty good stuff, but at the end of the night, it was a disaster and it was a mess. And I don't know.
It sounds like Nestor has actually created almost like a chart, you know, of effect of, you know, he would drink a little bit and then sort of hit this sweet spot. And then, as you say, just collapse into sort of a mess.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the prolific, the profane Jacksonville poet, Alan Justice, with some of the people who knew him best. If you have memories to share or questions, you can reach out on social media or email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And of course, you can call us at 904-549-2937. We're joined now on the line by Shelton Hull, who knows him from way back, was a good friend of Alan Justice's. Good morning, Shelton.
Good morning.
What are you thinking about Alan this morning?
I'm thinking just how much he would enjoy sitting and listening to this and seeing all this that happens. And you know, he'd be proud, but also kind of shocked and surprised that we actually saw this project through to the finish.
Do you have any particular memories of Alan that you think inform who he was, help people understand him a little better?
I'd say that, yeah, I mean, when I first met him, I was probably 16 years old, the Steve Padgett, I think it was Steve Padgett, the article in Folio Weekly back in 94. I was 16 and I read it, and I remember calling him, because I had to call White's bookstore to get his number, because he was living behind Mr. Chamberlain's house at the time, and I called him, and it was, you know, one of my first experiences with white people. It's a great way to get started. And as a, for me, as a mentor, as a journalist, I dropped out of college and I got started doing this work. And, you know, people told me for years that it was pointless to do it. If it wasn't for Alan Justice, I would have never stuck with it long enough to actually have any type of success. And that's kind of the person he was. He taught us, I can't speak for everyone else, but he taught me to do the work for just the joy of doing it. Everyone wants to make money and, you know, be in the cool parties and, you know, hopefully publish and do, you know, radio and TV and all those kinds of things. But what Alan taught me was that if the process itself didn't give you joy, and if the subject matter didn't give you joy, then the work itself would ring through inauthentic and have no value for the readers. I remember I would sit with him, you know, he would look at manuscripts of things I was writing, and we'd talk about rhythm and pacing and, you know, because it was a unique thing. The idea, you know, this is like the 90s, the idea of a black person being a professional writer anywhere in this part of the country, let alone being able to pay your bills off, it was an absurd sort of thing. But thankfully, he also thought it was absurd, which gave him a little passion for the thing, and he enjoyed that. He took more pride and pleasure from seeing his friends succeed than he did for himself. There are a lot of opportunities that he had to, you know, he could have been, you know, filthy rich. He could have been about as popular as one can be with that work. He was a remnant of that era when writing mattered, back when people would fight over whose poetry was best, back when reporters would fight with each other over who could get to the telephone first to call in the copy on their stories. When I started writing for Folio, back when you were working there as well, you were my editor for 10 years, I would write things out longhand and then go down to the library and type things up on the IBM Selectric 2 typewriters down the basement, then walk it over to Kinko's and send it in by fax machine. Now I write my columns like on Google Docs, like while sitting on the balcony somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's an entire shift in the way the work is done, the materials that are used to do it.
I mean, he was something of a throwback, even when he was doing his work, of course, you know, working on this computer in this very sort of rudimentary environment. And we've got a call, Joseph from Riverside. Good morning. Go ahead, Joseph.
Good morning. Distinguished panel this morning, and I would be remiss if I lost the opportunity to say that both Anne and Walter are both huge inspirations to me. You both inspired me during your time at Folio to have an interest in investigative journalism, and I actually got the chance to write with Folio for a short period on the topic of environmental justice. Now, on to Alan Justice. I'm interested in his place in the Jacksonville literary scene and his place in poetics at large. I'd be interested to hear more about his style and his influences, and maybe Tim can shine some light on how he relates to other Jacksonville writers. And as a follow-up question, are there any plans to publish poetry collections? As a poet myself, a member of the Jacksonville literary scene, I'd be overjoyed to be able to read some of his work. Thank you.
Thanks, Joseph. Appreciate the call. So let's talk a little bit about that, Tim, in terms of the quality of his work. You wrote in a recent post on your blog, Jack Psychogeo, that Alan Justice was not a master, a fine arts poet. He was not polished. And, you know, when you look at his work through a hard filter, I mean, it was riddled with misspellings. He refused to write, rewrite, or edit. Talk a little bit about the quality of his poetry.
That's a tough question, you know, because he was so prolific, and I think he valued the writing that he did in the particular moment almost as an, well, I was going to say almost as an artifact of that moment, but I don't think I think for him, the poetry was what he did. It was about the action of writing poems. You know, he was obviously hugely influenced by Bukowski. I think everybody who had met Alan more than a couple times heard about him getting thrown into the drunk tank with Bukowski in the 60s in LA. One person that I think is really useful to kind of put up as a foil almost to Alan's writing is Lynn Scapiak. Lynn Scapiak Harlan. You know, you could look at the fact that
she's a local writer and
yeah,
poet as
she's,
well.
Right.
And
friends
with Alan.
Yeah. Yeah. And Lynn is somebody who does not sugarcoat anything. And, you know, and she says, you know, writing is a blood sport. That's a thing that she says. And you know, she would tell Alan exactly what she thought about whatever he was doing in a particular moment. But the thing is that Lynn, will revise a single poem 30 or 40 times, whereas Alan did not believe in, revising at all. And so you can think whatever you want to think about that, you know. You're absolutely right about the spelling mistakes and everything else. You know, he He was totally unpolished as somebody could be. I mean, it really was to the extent that the writing of poems was the life.
I think you quoted Lynn, a poem that she wrote that said,
yeah.
Does he even think for a moment he's a genius?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That poem, she wrote that poem, for Alan Justice, and it's not flattering at all, but apparently he liked it. You know, she helped, the caller asked about publications. She helped, was one of the two people, Lynn and George Gilpatrick, published Alan's, chapbook of Alan's, called Fishing in the Dark in 2001. He had some earlier chapbooks. There was one, Freedom at its worst angle in the mid 90s. And then there were some other things published later. It would be really interesting. And I think Nestor Gill would be, the person that I would want to ask about, doing something else with Alan's writing at this point, publication wise.
Well, let's hear a little from Alan himself. This was a conversation he had with you, Troy, about his writing style. Let's listen.
It's just something that I do. I don't sit down with some grand idea of what this poem is going to be about. I never sit down and give a title and write something about it. I write something and realize that what I've written is about it, and it is in there, and it is the title. So there's a particular pattern. Eskew even said that. He said, man, he said, after thousands of pages of stuff I've read of yours, he said, have you ever noticed that all of your poems end right near the bottom of a piece of paper? You always wind up ending right near the bottom of the page. It's like, that's where it's supposed to end? Or at least that's what he said. I mean, hell, I don't know. I never know what I'm doing anyway. I find out later, somebody hits me upside the head with a beer bottle or they throw me in jail.
It's interesting, Tim, that you mentioned asking Nestor, because, he did say at one point, while I love Alan's poetry, I've read more that I did not like than the ones that I did. But he had a pretty traumatic childhood. You kind of alluded a little bit earlier to his relationship with his father, but tell us what we know about how his father treated him and his sister.
Well, from talking to Grace, she told me that, and I had heard that Alan's father could be cruel. Troy had told me that a little bit, and I knew that Alan's father had committed suicide in the early 1990s, a couple days after Christmas. And Grace told me about how Alan's father, who was a psychologist, would leave in the morning and tell Alan and his sister that they had to stay in their bunks all day long. They were not to get out of their bunks, and that he would cover the floor in flour to try and capture any footprints, if they were to get out of bed. I think it was, this was something people used to talk about parents doing, but when parents caught their kids smoking, but his father seemed to take it to a whole different level, that he caught Alan smoking and made him smoke a whole pack, right on the spot, and then punched him in the stomach until Alan threw up. I don't know how old Alan was at the time, but he was a kid, he was definitely a hard man. He was definitely a shadow that haunted Alan throughout his life.
Walter, he's sometimes compared, as we've mentioned, to the celebrated but definitely pre-Me Too era writer Charles Bukowski. But he actually did run into Bukowski. He met him personally.
Yeah, I remember that story we had him write about that experience. And it was remarkable. I wish I had that issue still.
They were fighting over a woman and kind of both ended up in the drunk tank.
I believe it was in L.A. And I'm not sure how they ended up being, meeting up or whatever, how that all happened. But it was pretty remarkable. It was something that almost sounds like you know, made up, but, you know, I guess it was true.
But Bukowski actually wrote a couple poems in which he wrote under Alan as a pseudonym, calling him Billy Thong. And then Alan wrote a poem about that called Fishing in the Dark. Let's listen to that.
Fishing in the dark. In the dark, in a boat, in a lagoon. In a night of drinking for the fish eyes hooked to the star's sight. Billy, did you ever look at all of them and wonder about all the distance between us and them? Yeah, I said. Once when I was 4, and since then I've only marveled at the distance of us, only 3 feet apart, or the cosmos room overflowing with people. I fished for the cans of beer and didn't come up empty, and upon reflection the water made the stars seem to move. We were only fishing in the dark, in a boat, in a lagoon, and we had time to think. A universe just 3 feet apart. You know, Billy, that's a good way to put it.
Well, we're talking about Jacksonville poet Alan Justice. He is the subject of a new special collection at the Jacksonville Main Library. Claire, you put together this special collection at the library. What can people expect if they come to see it? And then there's an event coming up this week.
Mm-hmm. The collection is ready and available for the public to view. It is behind the scenes in special collections, just for shelving. And they just have to ask a special collections librarian to view it, and we'll bring it out probably one box at a time. It is 38 boxes. It's a large body of work. And then we have the event on Saturday at 2 p.m., honoring his life, and moderated by Nestor Gill, and with panel discussion and looking at his life and legacy and reading of his poems and viewing of the documentary.
So who all is going to be taking part in that?
Nestor is moderating the program. I believe Walter will be there, and Tim Gilmore, who's here, and Troy. Is Shelton going to be there as well? Yes. And it'll be a great time. People can register for the program by calling 255-BOOK, and that'll get them connected to us.
Troy, Alan was a difficult person, as we've mentioned. He could be difficult on people, and you talked to him about that. I want to ask you about that, but let's hear a little bit from your interview with him on that subject.
As you said, you know, in your emails and stuff like that, I've insulted an awful lot of people. I've said things to people that have been very, very insulting. But I would like to think or feel that more often than not, those things that I said, no one ever said to them and gave them the thought that came from what I said to them.
He says he takes responsibility for it. Is this a product of the drinking? I make the documentary, leave it up to the viewers. Like, is his obnoxiousness part of the drinking, or is it part of Alan Justice? Is not exactly black and white. And what I wanted to capture mostly in this documentary was the both sides, where you had this pleasant person who's the best person maybe in the world to talk to. And as the drinks come, he turns into this monster of nasty person and just the worst person you could be around.
Walter, how about your relationship with Alan? I mean, you saw him in many guises, many different places over the years.
Yeah, he was one of the things I wanted to add was, and I'm, by the way, kind of shaken by his voice. I haven't heard it in a long time.
It is a weird feeling.
But I had a daughter born just a little while, about a year after I met him. And he never, ever, ever failed to ask me about her. And it wasn't just a casual, you know, approach. It was like a genuine interest. And he was a very sensitive, caring person that I experienced. And I hear there's been a lot of criticism of his, you know, he was a gruff person on the outside, but he was a pretty tender soul on the inside. And that was, something that I always held close.
We have an email from Trisha. She says, I loved that problematic man. He had an eerie way of seeing the soul of a person almost on first meeting. Such a true poetic soul and such an important reminder that great artists come in many shapes and forms. This was, you know, an, he emerged at a time when there was a really dynamic scene that was happening. Troy, for people who weren't around in that time period, remind us a little bit what it was like in the competitive poetry scene.
Yeah, well, I don't fashion myself a poet, but but yes, we had Al and Nestor and Alan. It did seem like we really did have a thriving scene in Five Points, and it was edgy, and I think somehow Jacksonville's lost some of that, and with Alan's death, that's been more of a decade. It just seems like we don't have that iconic person or those kind of gatherings that exist, as far as I know, anymore.
I want to play another excerpt of my interview with Nestor Gill. Again, he's the one who basically maintained this collection. He talks about how he obtained Alan's vast, you know, collection of writings and how he eventually found it a home.
At the library in the special collections, there's at least one note that I wrote to Alan back then that, you know, said, hey, old man, listen, you're going to die someday. Not soon, I know. We hope not soon. We hope not ever. You'll probably outlive us all. But probably we should write down somewhere that when you die, you should give me your stuff. And what I meant by stuff was really his manuscripts, his pages, because we're talking about a stack of pages taller than me, and I'm 6'1". It's a giant, massive amount of work. And I just understood even early that someone should hold on to it, because otherwise it might wind up in the trash. And then last year, I reached out to my friend Alicia Burton Levasseur, who works for the library, and she pointed me toward Laura Miner. And instantly, as soon as Laura Miner got involved, her sense of like the importance of the archive, her vision for what it meant to the library, to the community of writers, to the city itself, to how we think about ourselves, to how we remember ourselves as a community. I think that she was immediately able to see what was possible there. And so she replied almost instantly, yes, we would love to take on this collection. And from there, the conversation just only grew more and more fruitful. And they've been treating his collection there at the library with, I mean, just such a beautiful amount of respect that, like, I just wish Alan were alive, because I don't know that he would have envisioned his legacy looking like this, but that he has this legacy that's being carried forward and solidified as an important part of Jacksonville's history is just wonderful. And I think Laura Miner has a lot of credit to take.
How does it feel to you personally to release that archive that you've carried with you for so long?
It's really great. But it's really great in the way that, I mean, it's not my work, right? It's really much more, you've been a steward or a shepherd of something, and it's been the kind of thing that wakes you up sometimes thinking, what am I going to do with this closet full of boxes, full of poems? Where will it go? I wouldn't use the word burden, because it has never felt like one, but it has felt like a responsibility. I guess the overall feeling is like, you know, arriving at the next logical phase. I mean, how long was I going to hold on to these things before they just became part of Nestor's stuff when he died? They belong where they can be seen by the interested. So I'm overjoyed. I'm so happy they're home. I'm glad that the work is where it belongs. It belongs to the city of Jacksonville. It was made there by one of its sons. And so it is right where it needs to be.
Claire, I want to ask you about how you received this initially. It, you know, I think of Alan, obviously, as kind of a chain smoking dude. I almost feel like there must have been an aroma to some of these papers in his collection. Was there any reluctance, any skepticism at the library at all initially about, you know, taking on this massive, massive project?
Not at all. I mean, 14 boxes that Nestor brought us, it did look a bit daunting initially. But it had been so well stewarded and shepherded by Nestor that it was in great shape as far as an unprocessed collection goes. It was very impressive. And certainly there's some pages that have things spilled on them and have seen the age of time and have seen better days. But no, there was no hesitation for us.
I mean, speaking of things, you know, spilled on them, he had a way of describing poetry. Nestor was saying he described people who wrote as either bleeders or pukers, Tim. That was kind of the phrase that he had. Nestor said Alan was more of a bleeder. And I don't know if I fully understand the word, you know, what that means for a poet, but he certainly was an evocative writer.
He was, yeah. I would have to ask Nestor myself. I'm not sure what the bleeder or puker thing. Do you guys, Troy or Walter?
I don't know. I haven't heard that.
Yeah, I would just probably coming from the soul and taking a toll of your body itself. I would probably venture that's what that means.
Yeah. I mean, he was pretty invested in his work. But there was an interesting episode, Tim, I believe you wrote about, when he was invited to read alongside some beat poets in Gainesville. Tell us about that.
Yeah. You know, I, in writing the story that I posted at Jack Sacagawea last week, I was really interested in finding kind of the before Alan. I mean, this was Alan, but it was Alan before I had ever met him and before everything I knew about him, really, except for, you know, the Bukowski story and a couple of other things. So I was really interested to find out about Alan in the late 60s at then Florida Junior College and then in the 70s. And he first met Grace in the 70s. She told me about a couple places around Riverside that he stayed and they stayed together. So interestingly, even back in the 70s, Riverside was Riverside, you know. He was invited to participate in a reading at the University of Florida in Gainesville, mid-70s, and some of the most famous poets in America were going to be reading there. Allen Ginsberg read there. Michael McClure read there. Gary Snyder read there. I think Lawrence Ferlinghetti was supposed to read there, but couldn't make it for whatever reason. And Alan, from my understanding, was kind of like the opening act, and he was incredibly intoxicated and apparently could hardly stand up. And this is something Alan himself talked about and wrote about quite a bit, certainly not his proudest moment. He apparently was unable to read a single poem, fell into the lake, which was the backdrop, and his papers went flying everywhere. And, you know, again, not his proudest moment, but a moment that he himself talked about and, also wrote about, later on.
Well, he's a man with an amazing legacy. I want to thank you all for being here. Claire Manos, Walter Coker, Troy Lucarilla, and Tim Gilmore. Appreciate you all being here today and talking about Alan.
It's been our pleasure.
Happy to be here.
Up next, free local music, free lunch, and art inspired by the fight for racial justice. A million in a drop-dead suit. Touch your pink on a downtown train. $2 pistol, but the gun won't shoot. I'm in the corner on the pouring rain. 16 men on a dead man's chest. And I've been drinking from a broken cup. 2 pairs of pants and a mohair vest. I'm full of bourbon, I can't stand up. Hey, little bird, fly away. Your house is on fire, children on the road. Hey, little bird, fly away. Your house is on fire, your children are alone. Schaefer broke a bottle on Morgan's head. And I've been stepping on the devil's tail. Across the stripes of a full moon's head. And through the bars of a Cuban jail. Bloody fingers on a purple knife.
It's Jazz Appreciation Month. I'm Kiana Faircloth.
And I'm Ulysses Owens Jr. Starting Sunday, April 21st, we're excited to bring you Jazz Beyond Tradition.
An exploration of jazz voices from the past, present, and future. This show will feature engaging interviews with local, national, and international artists and public figures alike.
April 21st at 7 p.m. on WJCT News 89.9 and online at WJCT.org.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
On the next Electro Lounge, we've got jazz to celebrate Jazz Appreciation Month. Tune in for music from Blue Monk, Bird Moves, and Ahmad Jamal. It's the Electro Lounge, only on WJCT News 89.9, 10 p.m. Saturdays.
If you feel like you're paying more for groceries since the pandemic, you are not alone.
You know, we haven't seen food price inflation like this in an election year in some time.
How inflation and food prices are affecting voters and potentially the 2024 election on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Florida Roundup, history happened here. There are hundreds of historical markers across the state, noting the newsworthy and notorious. Some may be less than factual. Do you pass by one of those square metal markers? Have you ever stopped to read it? What story does it tell? Email us radio@thefloridaroundup.org. I'm Tom Hudson. Then join us Friday at noon.
Are former U.S. presidents immune from federal criminal prosecution? That's the unprecedented question before the Supreme Court. With Donald Trump facing dozens of criminal charges, the case could have major consequences this election year. I'm Michelle Martin. Join me for live special coverage of oral arguments in Trump versus United States from NPR News.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
We're back, and you can hear Yaya's music, so you know she's in the house. I've got Yaya Cardona and our favorite dog in a handbag, Mambo.
Yeah, who's a little cold today. Good morning, buenos dias.
Good morning. Nice to have you.
It's such a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
It is gorgeous out. And again.
I know. We're having great weather, and so I'm really excited about that.
So Yaya is here. She is every Thursday.
Yes.
To give us what's happening this week in culture. What's cooking?
Todos los jueves. Thursday in Spanish is jueves.
Huevos.
Jueves.
I'm just kidding. I'm playing with you.
Well, so if you guys know, if you guys want to follow us, make sure you go to the website createjax.com, C-R-E-8-J-A-X.com. You can see the full list of everything that's going on all around Jacksonville, but we're going to highlight some specific ones. I'm starting with tonight with River Jams, the last night of it's River Jams.
Free music, and we're going to have to say goodbye to the River Jams.
Yeah, until next year. Yeah. It's one of my favorite programs that Downtown Vision has, and tonight is Andy Grammer. So check that out. That is a free event that starts at 5 p.m., and they have Let's Ride Brass Band, one of my favorite local bands, playing tonight. It's completely free. Come out with your family, bring your blankets. The weather is beautiful.
Yeah.
And let's have a good time.
Perfect night.
Oh yeah. And let's go ahead and start talking about Mañana Friday, because there's a lot going on this weekend.
All right.
Tomorrow Friday is the exhibit opening of one of my favorite artists, Overstreet Ducas, is at Yellow House, and it's called Overdue. Yeah. And the exhibit is sparked by Colin
Kaepernick,
thank you, protests against the racial injustice and police violence. So check that out. That's going to be at Yellow House from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. completely free. And it'll be up for a couple months. So yeah.
And he's an incredible artist, a Jacksonville treasure. So
one of my favorites. I just put up one of his artworks on my wall. So I'm really excited to add him on my collection.
Yeah.
Tomorrow Friday also, for all of our podcast lovers, you definitely need to check this out. Is the intersection of music, podcasting, and artist advocacy with Kiana Faircloth at the Jesse DuPont Center. And it's hosted by our very own Matt Shaw from the Jacksonville Music Experience. She is a radio personality, a writer, artist advocate who will be discussing her career specifically in the jazz, public radio, and podcasting.
That's a free lunch, but you got to register. And of course, Kiana will be on our program tomorrow. She's going to be talking about the Jazz and Jacks event on Saturday on the WJCT soundstage.
That's great. And then for tomorrow night, if you don't have any plans, one of my favorite DJs here in Jacksonville, DJ Nick Fresh, is going to be having a disco fever night.
No.
Yes, straight up, like Studio 54, nothing but 70s music with a little bit of modern twist, because he's great at mixing. So that's going to be at Hardwick's tomorrow night in downtown Jax.
That's a fun new venue.
Oh, it is. It's such a nice upscale bar. I love it. It's really nice. And obviously with Nick Fresh being in the house, you can never go wrong with that. I do want to shout out really quickly, San Jose Elementary School is having a an event for the families to come out from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. They're going to have free pantries, giveaways for the kids. So check that out at San Jose Elementary Saturday from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. And afterwards is the opening of the beaches this weekend.
Wow. It's that time already?
It's already. La playa. I'm excited because I'm
vamos a la playa.
Oh, vamos a la playa. Muy bien, amiga. I'm excited to get this yellow out. I look like a Simpson right now. So check that out. Starting this whole weekend is the opening of the beaches from Friday to Sunday. They're starting off tomorrow Friday with a silent disco party, Hush Hush, from 7 to 10 p.m. Mm-hmm. Then Saturday, starting at 9 a.m., they have a volleyball tournament. They have a sandcastle competition that starts at 2 p.m.
And those people are nuts.
Oh, the sandcastle?
Yeah, they're really intense.
Oh, I'm excited. When I lived in Virginia, I remember growing up going to those, so I can't wait to go to Jack's. For all of our fishers, they have a fishing tournament at the pier. And on Sunday is the parade that starts at 2 p.m. at 5th Avenue and 2nd Street.
I mean, I love a parade.
Mm, you can never go wrong.
Right.
So check that out. That's the at the beaches this whole weekend. I also... want to talk about National Day of Healing this Saturday. There's an event to celebrate National Day of Healing. Attendees can expect a day of fun at Phillips Randolph Park. They'll have bounce houses, kickball contests, and all that jazz.
Yeah, this is the last day of National Crime Victims Week. One of the organizers was on our program this weekend. He said, you know, it's been a very solemn week, but this is a chance for families to have fun and smile a little bit.
I'm excited for that. Anything that's happening on in Phillips Randolph Park, I'm here for it. So check that out. That's going to be this Saturday. And one last event that we want to highlight is Wildcrafters this Sunday is having a dance meditation yoga dance party starting at 10 a.m.
Wait, stop. Explain.
Yes, it's going to be a lot of fun. Our friend Matt Cole, I always pronounce the last name. Don't kill me wrong, Matt. Matt Coachella. Thank you. He is leading the meditation at Wildcrafters this Sunday at 10 a.m. And then they're going to have a spiritual dance party, which is just live music to just have a good time. So check that out. And again, check out the full list of events at createjax.com and follow me on Instagram. Yaya Love Jax.
Well, Yaya, thanks so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you. And have a beautiful weekend, amigos.
Join us again tomorrow when we discuss the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Week in Review panel. And stick around. After the news, we'll be joining NPR's live coverage of oral arguments in former President Trump's immunity case before the Supreme Court. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.